Accession number 10037, reel number 5.
On my visit to one of the compounds where the Chinese store all their stuff, on going in, we used to go there to get our diesel fuel for our generating station. And on one day, as I went in, about 50 yards away from the entrance, I used to see this, looked like a Japanese guard, just sitting against the wall. And on the second time, he was still sitting there. And so I said to the chap again, I said, he's a lazy devil up there. He's always sitting there and having a sleep. And the chap said, oh, he's not asleep. He said, they shot him 3 days ago. And this is the kind of thing that happened in those out there. You know, it seemed to be. And on another occasion, I had a Chinese interpreter at Peshi. And I used to have this generating station, and we contrived a cooling system of two big 50-gallon drums on top of one another where the water circulated, and then it used to come out the other end in like a shower bath to cool it, because it was very hot at Peshi then. And one day the old engine started spluttering and banging, and of course we rushed over there, and the water had got low. Now there was a Chinese coolie that had been appointed to keep it topped up, and he used to go down to the river and bring his yo-yo pole up with two buckets and top it, and he'd gone to sleep. And the interpreter was so mad, and he yelled and shouted, and then he administered his own punishment. He told him to hold his hand out, and he hit him with an enormous iron file right across his hand. I think it would break every bone nearly in your finger. And that was his instant punishment for not keeping the cooling water going. I mean, of course, these interpreters, and he was actually an officer, and they were laws unto themselves.
Did you hear anything about the communists while you were there?
Very, very little. Very little. I knew that. Mind you, I wasn't interested in their politics or any of the politics that was going on really in the country then. You know, it wasn't. I wasn't a political animal. I knew there were communists up north that were, they knew, fighting and would eventually come south, but didn't really hear much about it, and it wasn't discussed much at all. Really, yeah. As a matter of fact, I've learned a lot more about it since when I was there, about the political thing that was going on then.
Mm. When you knew you had to leave the Flying Tigers, you know, was it upsetting for you in a way?
Well, it wasn't. The only other thing, I thought it might be an opportunity I should be getting nearer to coming home. But I didn't know. And then, yeah, you take those things philosophically. I'd been so used to going from here to there. I'd been on the move ever since right from the last November, and this was nearly, I suppose, over a year then, and I'd been on the move, and the adrenaline flowing all the time, and it was a very upsetting, unsettling period, really. You don't realise it until you get back. And I realise it now. It probably took me 10 years to settle down afterwards when I got home. I was always on the move, doing exciting and daft things. And
it was unsettling for you,
wasn't
it?
Yeah, I was always looking for excitement.
Yeah.
I realised it now. Well, my wife would bear me out. Yeah. I took up horse riding a lot. Well, I used to ride before. And doing mad things. I used to ride, when I got back, the station I was on, there was a farmer nearby who used to be a horse dealer, and he used to get all people's misfits and all. I used to go and ride these and all things like that. And then I took up sailing, and we used to cross the channel and do all kinds of things. We've been called Aiding Gales and all, until it got, I realised too much for my wife. And then I think it was then I began to settle down. But it's amazing, you know. It may not have been anything to do with it, but I realise now that it does. You know, the adrenaline flows up for those several years you're out there, and you don't settle down easy. I moved about 8 times in the first 6 years, I think, or 7 years when I came back.
Do you think it was the Flying Tigers period more than any other, or?
Well, I think it was more. I think it was the excitement and the adrenaline, and you know, seem to be always looking for action. Someone did something to happen. You know, when you got back, and nothing, did happen, you know, you get bored and you'd make things happen or try to. I think, you know, probably that's a bit of self-analysis, it might be wrong, but I don't think it was.
In the books about the flying tigers, I'm sure you've read quite a few.
I've only read that one that I had, yeah.
Yes. Well, the book you loaned me, by a man, was it Heifermann, isn't it? Heifermann. Yeah. And you weren't mentioned in it, were you?
No, they wouldn't mention the RAF in that. It's an American organisation. I don't suppose, probably that chap hardly knew I existed. I mean, he dug it all up, I expect, from other places. He didn't experience it. He wasn't there. It was more political, that, than anything else, wasn't it?
Well, I'm glad the record's being put right today.
I was only basically, really, just one of a number. I mean, the pilots were the main things there. And, you know, what I did was incidental.
Yes, but your role would seem, listening to your account, quite vital.
I think it was. I mean, really, you didn't realise at the time, but looking back, it was. The communications and all that. And, of course, poor old Chenault, who could add to it. He's not here with us anymore. I'm sorry he died.
Did you ever have any contact with any of
not
them
afterwards? Not once, no. I left them not.
Did you have a send-off for a party or anything before you broke up?
Well, they had parties all the time. To be honest. What they called parties. Mm. But a lot of them used to drink a lot. You know, they did. You know, they were typical American time of the war. They were all over. Well, I used to think they weren't very fit blokes. They were overweight. And, you know, they seemed, a short life and a merry one seemed to be their philosophy, whether it was so. Of course, a lot of them did get. A lot of nice chaps. Some of them were quite. That one that was in charge of Ascot and Captain Olsen was a nice chap. He was of Danish or Swedish origin, and he was very thoughtful. You know, there were such a varied types. There were the crazy ones, you know, that were obvious, and then there were you often made me wonder why they did it. There was another one, Arnold. He was a very quiet one, and he afterwards was flying the transport over the hump, and he ran into the side of the mountain, you know, into the fog would come down and he got lost, but he was a nice chap too. Okay, Dad.
Chenault, am I right in thinking, you know, you from your character description earlier, that he wasn't crazy like the pilots?
Oh, no, he was a very sedate, you know, level-headed sort of a man. Really, you know, quiet and but very straight. I mean, he would come and talk to you. He wasn't reticent in any ways, and he was always open-minded and talk. And would discuss things, though. I mean, he was a general, and at that moment, I was really an AC-2 in the Air Force. But he would discuss things and talk quite openly with you, and even ask you if you thought it would work, or you know, with regard to the radio, which was my job at the moment.
Did you ever see, I'm wondering if the time would have been right while you were there, General Stilwell?
No, never saw. I may have seen him on one of the planes going through, but I didn't, not really, I never saw him.
The other thing I was going to ask you, how did your health stand up in the Chinese
remarkably
situation?
Well, except I used to get dysentery, but I never. You know, you put up with it and it would cure itself within a day or two. But I never went on a sick parade the whole time I was overseas. Not once. From late 41 to 45 when I got back.
Well, were there dangers, though, in China that you were aware
of? Oh, yes. I mean, there were malignant malaria. There was amoebic dysentery. There were all kinds of people. Some of the chaps, one caught smallpox actually, and typhoid was quite odd, and paratyphoid, I think, which is a lesser typhoid, quite a number of cases and typhoid and things like that went on. But as I say, except for the occasional bout of dysentery, I kept remarkably fit, really. I was really more frightened of snakes than most things while I was there, because in one of our little outstations, I can't quite call mine exactly where it was, one of the chaps, we had a radio station in a kind of a semi-dugout, and it was barbed wire around, and we used to take a shortcut and get through the barbed wire and down, and he came into the cabin and said, oh, he said, I caught my leg on the barbed wire as I came through, and he was looking a bit funny, and the chaps looked at him, and then they could see on his leg were just two punctures marks on it, and they rushed him down to the MI room, they took him down, but he died within about a quarter of an hour, and apparently it was a crate, a very short snake, which is only about 18 inches long, but deadly poison. It must have been laying near a barbed wire, and he thought he'd caught his leg on the barbed wire, but it wasn't a barbed wire, it was a snake.
Did they have a medical service, the Flying Tigers?
Well, they had a doctor who used to go around. Doc Richards was the one I knew, and he used to walk, he was a very jovial sort of man. He used to walk about, all he used to wear was a pair of shorts or a pair of slacks, and he'd be walking across the airfield, and he'd say, oh, have you had your so-and-so jab lately? And he said, well, I don't know. He said, well, you better come and have one then. And he'd go and get your bag and stick a needle in your arm. And that, you know, he was a very, rather a burly sort of a man. But apparently he must have been a very good doctor, because they didn't seem to get a lot of illness. The chaps didn't.
How about the wounded, you know, when they were downed planes wounding?
I don't know really what happened to them. I don't know where they went to. I think they must have had a hospital somewhere where they were taken to, but I didn't really know, because with most of the pilots, if they either got killed or they did, you know, they didn't seem to. I didn't know any who got to. I think I remember seeing one with a broken arm once, but he had it in a sling, but I don't know where they were treated. I think the Chinese had hospitals, and whether they went to those or not, in Chongqing, Kunming, I don't know.
Did you ever see other British people there, you know, in Kunming or Chongqing?
I didn't see any in Kunming, only I saw some of the RAF that got out of Burma, a small number, did come to us in Kunming. Apparently, the RAF lent the Flying Tigers about a dozen to overhaul their transports, their cars and lorries and things that they had. But they were only there a few days when I went off up to Chongqing. So I met them and I had a lot of their stories. They were the small group that had been left behind, you know, to destroy. And they'd got out via China. And I afterwards linked up with them when I was sent back, and we all congregated in Chengdu for a few weeks before we came down. Then over I think it was the old Silk Road from Chengdu down to Kunming, which took us about 10 days and went up to, I believe, over 11,000 feet. We slept in our lorries and it was freezing cold. Some mornings we'd wake up and the hoar frost on the trees, a blade of grass would be about an inch in diameter with all frozen. And we just we had our blue on and we used to try and make a cup of tea or something like that, but the food for those 10 days was... Well,
you say you had your blue on, so you were re-kitted out, were you?
Yeah. They gave us some blue when we got to Chengdu. I got some. Yeah, they did.
Did you have
some.
To report? You know, was there any formality there with the
RAF?
No,
not at all. No, I just went there, and they knew where I was, and they knew what I was doing, really.
These other RAF people, what sort of experience had they had?
Well, they'd had some pretty grim experiences coming up the road. They were under an old sergeant called Sergeant Hudson, and he was about 50, and he led them. He was an engineer, I think, flight engineer, and he was more or less in charge of them, and he took responsibility and brought them up. Except, I think, when they got near, it may have been Kunming, they flew in two officers to take over this small unit, and that's when they had a distribution of medals, which wasn't very popular. And I think most of the RAF told them what to do with their medals. And the officer that was flown in, he took the major award, the OBE, and the pilot officer, I think, took the BEM. And there were more or less oak leaves and a few things left for the troops. But the fellows weren't very enamoured, and they told them what to do with them. In fact, one of the major awards went to one that was... I suppose he was like the rest of them, but nothing outstanding. And so they said, well, give it to so-and-so. And so they gave it to him.
They sounded pretty disgruntled with that.
They were extremely disgruntled. And then so, and I mean, it turned out. And as they were all told, more or less, when they got back to India, well, it was an episode which is best forgotten. And they were all given, we were all given about 3 weeks' leaves and all our back pay and that, and packed off to various places for our leave. And then we all were sent to different, we all came back to, I never met up with any of the other chaps.
Was that deliberate, do you think, to split you
up? I think
up?
It was.
I think these were the people you said were told to make their own way back.
Oh, yes, the adjutant had told them that Rangoon, he said, well, he said, if the Japs come in, he said, it's no good resisting them. He said, you must either give yourself up, and he said, if you do get out, make your way as best you can to India. Well, it was only about between 1,000 and 2,000 miles through the jungle. Little supplies. So you can imagine that. And then they'd been told that they would fly a plane in and take them out after they'd finished destroying, of course. That was impractical because the runway was destroyed, so they couldn't. So they just had to use their own initiative and get out. And their idea was, under the sergeant, they took a petrol bowser and about 3 or 4 lorries and filled it up with all that they thought they'd need. And their idea was to go up the Burma Road, all through China and back through Russia, back to England. But of course, they can't run wood before they got halfway up the Burma Road. And they sent these two officers in to take it over. And one of those was a Corporal Hutton, who was he was what they call a Willy Wheeler. He'd been an aircraft apprentice, and he was a charming young fellow, quite able as well, and very patriotic. And at Magui, when the Japs used to just come in and strafe, there were no warnings, and they all dived in slit trenches, and they were being in the middle of refueling an aircraft, but with no thought to himself, because fuel was very, very scarce. We couldn't get any more in, or they couldn't be any more in. He ran out of his slit trench, jumped in the cab and drove it all down the runway with the Japs strafing until he could find an opening to get out into the jungle. Saved it. If ever a bloke deserved a medal, he did, but he never got one. And afterwards, because he was a chap that was always volunteering, I understand he got shot down over Burma later when he'd volunteered to go down and service an aircraft which was stranded somewhere down in Burma, I think during the advance. That was, I think he was a sergeant then, Sergeant Pete Hutton. He could have only been in his early 20s.
I think you said you went to India, didn't you? Bengal, is that right?
Yeah. Well, yes, when we came down, well, they flew us right to the most northern part in Bengal, the shortest route, and then we came by a paddle steamer down the river, and then eventually onto a train and back to, down to Calcutta.
And that would have been over the hump, would it?
We flew over that from Kunming. Yes. From Kunming to Bengal, yeah, we came over.
Yes.
The hump. But the plane we flew in was an old DC-2. Of course, it couldn't fly over the hump. Its maximum height was about 15,000 feet. So we flew through the passes, more or less. It looked as though you could put your hands out and almost get the snow off the sides of the mountains. But, and of course, it was quite, could have been a hazardous trip, providing the visibility was all right. It was when the visibility closed down that they used to get the trouble. You see, the pilots would get caught and the clouds would come and they couldn't see. Well, it was a very dodgy.
It must have been a very busy route, wasn't it?
Well, it was, but not in the days I was there, because there were not many transports. Nothing was being sent out towards Burma or India. It wasn't until 1944... that stuff began to arrive, 43, 44. But up to 43, I mean, nothing was sent out there, to my knowledge, anyhow, because I suppose it was all required for the invasion of D-Day in Europe. And so I'm afraid Bengal and everything else was starved of stuff.
I think you told me you were in Bengal at the time of the famine,
yes,
weren't you, in
1943? Yes, in 43, late 43 in Bengal, and that was a terrible sight too. It was commonplace to see bodies laying around there that had died of starvation. And I once saw one that the dogs were eating. But then, where you see all the island people used to come around our cookhouse, and naturally they weren't allowed because of the risk of disease and things like that, and we used to carefully when we got our dinner, of course, to be honest, we hardly ate any of our dinner because our food was so terrible. We used to put all our food in one bin and our sweet in another bin, and then it used to be driven out, I think, about a mile or so, and given to the people to eat. And they weren't allowed into, you know, naturally near the camp, because it would have been a great health hazard. But I mean, it was terrible. I mean, when I was at Barrackpur then, and I used to go down to Calcutta, and you'd see small children down in the refuse pits picking up pieces of orange peel, anything they could get to eat there. I mean, suffering, well, I'm afraid we don't understand or know anything about it really until you. I hope things are much better. I'm certain they are in China, because they were going through a terrible time then.
Were the troops able to do, the forces, anything able to do anything for that famine, you know, to help?
Well, all they could do is to give supplies and take supplies out where they could, if they could get them, you see. I mean, otherwise, there was nothing one could do. You see, you didn't have the availability of food or any stuff that you could take to them or give to them. You, of course, there were plenty of beggars. You could give them annas and things like that. But even that is very difficult. I mean, there were problems. We used to have a bearer, which, of course, people think was probably not right. We used to have one who used to clean our boots and our buttons and everything else, and we used to pay him, I think, about 7 rupees a week. And we would have paid him a lot more, but we weren't allowed to pay him more because it would have caused so much disruption in the village that this man was earning, say, 40 rupees a week just waiting on us or helping us, and the other people in the village were just working like Billy O, could only make 7 rupees a week. So we were advised more or less what to give him. Mind you, we used to slip him a few odd rupees extra, but one could realise what would happen, which we did realise later on when the Americans began the attack, because they threw money about like water, and it caused an enormous amount of disruption. It caused inflation and all kinds of things for their own local population. You see, they had so much money, the Americans, when they came in, that they were throwing it about, and of course it made it not only difficult for other people like us, but it all made difficult among the Indians themselves, because they were, you see, it's...
Was there much anti-British feeling in your area, you know, in Bengal?
I met a lot of the Indians and I spoke to them, and we used to get on with them quite well. But you used to see slogans, you know, anti-British slogans and things like that, but I never incurred, you know, got involved in a lot of it. I used to go down to Calcutta a lot and used to walk along and that, and never anything like that. I then, this was in 1944, and I never got involved or saw anything. I used to go to the races sometimes, they're all among the Indians, and there's nothing, you know, they were all, I said, very, very polite. And then we had a marvellous cafe down there, or restaurant, called Furpo's. I think all the troops who went to India must know Furpo's in Calcutta, where you'd go in, you could get a marvellous meal, because it was like going almost to heaven. You'd go and sit down and you'd have about 4 bearers on your table, and you could get a marvellous meal there. We used to go occasionally.
But what work were you doing in India?
I was on the base radio station at Barrackpur. We had about 32 transmitters there, which used to...
Yes. Would you have been involved at all with the Battle of Imphal? You know, did that?
Well, we used to communicate to them, but actually, I think I was very lucky because of our experiences in Burma and, you know, the traumatic really condition we'd had there. We were screened at a base station. In other words, we weren't posted up, or at least I was never posted up forward again. You know, into the.
Did it seem tame after what you've been doing?
Well, it did. But, I mean, I was with another chap that I don't know whether he'd been with the RAF or not up in Burma. And I'd been with him, and we piled up, and we found a lot to do. We used to go to I'll be honest, the last year I had a marvellous time. We used to go to the Tollygunge Country Club, and used to go to the Calcutta Turf Club races. And, you know, and then I went down to the botanical gardens down there, and you see... be honest, what with all the back pay I'd had a year and a half's back pay, I had a nice little banking account in the bank at Calcutta. So I was able to, really, the last year or so, I really had a good time.
Was anyone in the RAF, you know, anyone in authority, interested in your experience with the Flying Tigers?
Not at all.
You weren't sort of...
I got a letter there. No, not at all. I had a letter there from, I think it was the colonel, in charge of the 10th Army, saying that I would report. And there was a note to report to wing commander, somebody who was in charge of something. And I went in to see him. He said, oh, well. He says, good show. And that was that. Was that.
What date did you go home then, to England?
Well, I can remember it quite well. I had a note from the orderly room to report to the adjutant's office, and this was in about November 44. And I went in, and it was my instructions to return home. That my period of overseas service had expired, so I retired and got all my clearances, which you have to, and then got on a train down to in Calcutta, and then went right across India again by train to Bombay. Well, when we got to Bombay, it was a transit camp up on the side of the hill, which was, you know, just a normal transit camp. Of course, we had nothing to do, but we waited and waited, and no boat came. But each day was quite nice. We used to go down, there's a lovely swimming pool there at Bombay, and we used to go swimming, and used to sit by the swimming pool, and the bears used to bring us tea and cake and enjoy that. And then we used to go to Juhu Beach, which is a beach farther out of Bombay, where it's all lovely sand and coconut trees and palm trees come right down to the water's edge, and used to go swimming. And but of course we were itching to get off, and it went on. I think we had to wait a month before the boat came, and eventually we went aboard the boat called the Multan, which is, I think, a boat that was specially designed for Far Eastern transport, because, you know, it had a lot of air flowing through it and things like that. And we set off, and we came up to the Red Sea, and then we transferred to the Strathmore, and then on up through the Suez Canal. Now, on that journey, naturally, you pal up with people and get talking, and I was talking to one chap and for a long time. And then we came through the Mediterranean. You change into your blue when you get to Mediterranean, because it begins to get cold, stopped at Gibraltar, and then eventually home to Liverpool. And it wasn't until about 2 days from me getting home, I was talking to the chap, and his name cropped up. You know, you just stand about looking over the rails, talking to one another. And his name was Austin. And I said, but you're not Bunny Austin, who went out in 1941. He said, yes, that's right. And then it was a chap that I'd powered up with on the boat going out. And he'd been a big 14-stone man. And coming home, he couldn't have weighed more than 8 stone. And he said, no, he was coming home. He'd had got a malignant malaria and amoebic dysentery. And he'd come up. And I'd been talking to him practically the whole of the journey, you know, occasionally for a little while each day. And I didn't realise it was the same chap that I'd powered up with coming out, not till I got nearly home. And then we got home. And
how
then
much did you weigh?
I weighed 8 stone when I got home. I was normally about 10'7". Yeah, I was down to 8 stone, and my weight is normally about 10'7". And then we had to wait for 3 days outside Liverpool, looking at that. We couldn't get ashore. And then when we did eventually get ashore, we had to go to Blackpool for 3 days to be, you know, before we got railway passes and had to go home on leave.
So it was a long time you were away, wasn't it, from your wife?
About 3.5 years. Yeah, 3.5 years. As I say, in the first 6 months, you didn't even know where I was. And then after that, when we were in China, we got very few letters. And then they devised a scheme whereby you sent... it was all put on microfilm or film, and the letters were flown and then printed out, and you got the letter printed, a kind of a photostat copy of a letter, which is quite small. I've still got a lot of them now.
And then, of course, you had this period of trying to settle down, which you've told me about.
Well, it was, yeah, very difficult. You know, you don't realise it, but you're always looking for I suppose it must be excitement. and or being moved, you know. They if you stop in one place for a few days, you start getting bored. And I mean, though my wife must have been extremely tolerant, I think we had 7 or 6 moves in the first 5 years after we got married, and I was doing all kinds of crazy things. I took up riding, then I took up sailing, and I don't know why. It takes a long time to gradually come back to normal. I think it may have been, I can only, you know, say it was that caused it. But
well, Mr. Jepson, thank you very much indeed for telling me about your experiences with the Flying Tigers. Thank you.
Okay, pleasure.